We're up to the fifth chapter. The Rav in the last chapter used the imagery of Shir HaShirim, of the lovers missing each other, and of the beloved knocking on the door, and described six knocks. I'm not going to go over it. And in this chapter, which we'll try to do quickly because there's a lot much more to come, the Rav speaks about whether the Orthodox community is answering the knocks. And a little background. During the period of time in the early 50s, there was negligible aliyah from America. To understand this, there are a couple of factors. One, that the American Jewish community was first becoming acclimated and successful. Obviously, there were Jews who came to America much earlier, but the bulk of American Jewry came to America between the 1880s and 1920, when immigration was cut off. It was their descendants, a generation that was born in America, that started to become economically successful. They were born in America, English was their native language. America did not put any serious restrictions on what kinds of schools they could go to. There were some problems here and there, but by and large, education was totally available to Jews, including college education. If most of the Jews lived in New York, the City University of New York was free. And anybody who had above a certain average got in free. It was not a wealthy community. So at this point, the Jews were making it in America, right? Why would they want to leave, right? It had taken an immigrant generation that could barely speak the language and wasn't formally educated and had a tough time of functioning economically. And now you have a generation, speaks the language, educated, becoming professionals. It certainly was not a generation that thought of leaving the country at this time, right? Certainly their parents didn't think of them doing so, one. Number two, initially, the way people looked at Israel was as a refuge, right? You're a refuge from people who have no place to go. You're not a refuge for people who don't need a refuge. So it was for the survivors of the war, right? Who were in DP camps. Not only were allowed to come to Israel, but that's what they wanted to do. And it was, they couldn't go back to their countries in East Europe. Those who went back and told and found pogroms when they went back. And their homes had been taken over by others who were not particularly quick to give them back. The next large immigration at this point were Jews who came from North Africa and other Arabic countries. And when the state of Israel was established, many of the Arabic countries threw them out. Again, it was a place of refuge for them. So this didn't fit into the way Americans looked at things. Now the Rav points out that a major problem for Israel, and we can see it in a somewhat different context when we talk about the territory conquered by the Six-Day War, but I'm still talking about 1956, was lack of population in certain areas. So the Jews have a long history of being urban. Right? In Europe, there were a few Jewish farmers, but most Jews were not farmers. So the Jews gravitated in large numbers to the cities. The Tel Aviv, Yerushalayim, Haifa. They didn't move down to the Negev. Well, you had Beersheba, which was a tiny town at the time, and you had to have farms and their own kibbutzim. This was not where they, most of them were ready to go. So the Rav said that one of the real problems that we faced was, why were the Arabs going to come and claim the territory? Because we didn't have anybody living there anyway. No. If we have people living there, it's not so easy to throw people out. But if we don't have anybody living there anyway, so his first complaint is that we're not coming. He said, well, you can complain about all the Jews. Why do you pick on the Orthodox Jews? Well, you pick on the Orthodox Jews because we expect more from us. We're the ones who are much more committed. So to say, well, look, the non-Orthodox are not coming, that's not an excuse for us. So that's the first thing he talks about, that we're not coming. All right? And while doing so, of course, the Rav can't help but discuss something halachic. Right. There's a dispute in the Talmud about the sanctity of Israel, or Kedushas HaAretz. So the Gemara talks about Kedusha Rishona, the initial sanctification of the land, which came at the time of Yahushua. Right? Now there's a machlokas, but the accepted view is Kedusha Rishona Kitcha L'Shata V'lo Kitcha L'Asid L'Avo. The first sanctification of Yeshua was temporary. Why was it temporary? Because it was based on conquering the land. It was based on conquering the land. If the land is conquered back by somebody else, then it's lost. Right? Because that which made it was the conquering. It only works when you're the ones in charge, when you've conquered it. If somebody else throws you out, it's gone. Kedusha Shnia, the second sanctification, which was done, it's used the Kedusha as Ezra, even though Ezra wasn't the first to come, is the Jews in Bayit Sheni with very short periods of time exception, and that was hundreds of years later, were not, they didn't physically conquer the land, right? Koresh gave them permission to come, and they settled. But they weren't independent in terms of control. For most of Bayit Sheni, we had some levels of autonomy, but we didn't have physical control. And the Rambam says that Kedusha Shnia, which was based on Yishuv, on living, so that doesn't lose it if it's conquered away from us. It doesn't depend on conquering. In the footnote, the Rambam points out that the same Rambam, the Rambam Trumos, says that Kedushas Mikdash is permanent, even though the base of Mikdash was destroyed twice. But the original Kedusha is permanent because the Kedushas Mikdash is dependent on the divine presence. And even the physical destruction of the land doesn't take away the divine presence. So that Kedusha is permanent. The Rebbe goes on to say it's a famous view that, and borne out to a great degree historically, that when no one came in and really took over the land in the sense, in a productive way. Yes, there were other people who lived in the land, and the Christians and the Muslims fought over the land during the Crusades, but no one really settled in a permanent way and built up communities and made, you know, made farming possible, made it economic. So it remained for us, right? The Zionist slogan, which some of the Arabs questioned, that it's exaggerated, was a country without land, a people without land, for a land without people, right? Okay, so the Rav's first point is that we were given an opportunity to come, should have come, and we didn't come. And because we didn't come, whole parts of the yeshuv are endangered because there's nobody living there. One. The next thing he points out is that the major financial givers who supported the yeshuv were not Orthodox Jews. So one might argue in defense that the major rich people were not Orthodox Jews. They could give more money because they had more money to give in the first place. But the Rav points out, nevertheless, that the Orthodox community was not a major component of giving. I think we'd have to bring the president of YU over to ask him who he raises money from, to find out how much of the money comes from Orthodox Jews and how much comes from others. The Orthodox community will, of course, always explain that it's much more expensive to be an Orthodox Jew, because you have to pay for day schools, and you have to have, you have to have a mikveh, and you have to have shuls, and you have to have a kosher butcher shop, and meat is more expensive, and a kosher bakery, etc., etc. But the fact of the matter is that our people were not major givers. All right, so this is what is his complaint. That he gives, and he makes calculations of how much money he gave. All right? And if we want to have impact in Israel, we have to have more people and more institutions. And to have institutions, you know, you have schools, someone has to pay for them. Right? They don't create themselves. And so this was a plea. Remember, this was the talk given in 1956 to religious Zionists, saying more of you should go in Aliyah, and if you're not going in Aliyah, at least be much more generous in what you give for Israel. Now, I'm doing it quickly because I want to get to the next one. All right. If it is true, as been established up till now, that the Orthodox community was only playing a minor role in the establishment of the state, and was not coming, right, on Aliyah, and was not giving a lot of money, so that meant somebody else was doing it. And who was doing it? Obviously, non-Orthodox Jews, secular Jews. The Rebbe did not discuss the whole Sephardic world, obviously. He just didn't discuss it. I'm bringing it up because the distinctions between the Orthodox and non-Orthodox are much clearer in the Ashkenazic world than it is in the Sephardic world. Right? The Sephardic world, first of all, never heard it before. But there were some rabbis who were more strict and some who were more lenient. And much of the Israeli population described itself as Mesorati. Unfortunately, the same word is used for two different things, which is confusing. Mesorati is also a conservative movement. But in Israel, Mesorati means traditional. Traditional means somewhat observant. It covers a wide gamut. But you don't have this religious secular, right? They're somewhere in between. So I'm going to leave that out because the Rebbe didn't discuss it. I don't want to leave it out in the sense that it doesn't exist, but it's not part of it. So if the state is established primarily by non-religious people, and if they are the ones populating the state, and if they are the ones giving all the money, so there's a problem. We see the state as having religious value, and yet it's coming from non-religious sources. And this has been a problem that split the Orthodox community from the very beginnings of the Zionist movement. From the very beginning of the Zionist movement, a significant percentage of the Orthodox community, including the Orthodox rabbinate, said look at this treif. It's coming from non-religious Jews. It's not coming from people who believe in Torah. How can it be? How can it have religious significance? And then you had the minority, whether it was the Zionists, who said, no, it's still significant, we can work together with the secular. So, in starting with chapter 6, the Rav is going to develop a religious justification for accepting a state that's run by the non-religious. And he's going to use categories that he spoke about in the very beginning of the whole article, which of fate and destiny. Remember, he used them in terms of response to suffering. Fate is what it's basically what we're forced to go through. Destiny is what we choose. Now he's going to take these terms and modify their usage somewhat and apply it to the Jewish people. So he does this by talking about two different covenants. If we look at Yetzias Mitzrayim, so Yetzias Mitzrayim, all the Jews who are in Egypt are being saved. And then they go on Mamre HaSinai and they accept the Torah. So it's a two-stage process. They're taken out of slavery. The Rav talks about Bris Mitzrayim and Bris Sinai. Bris Mitzrayim is the covenant in Egypt of the fate of the Jewish people. All people, what was necessary to survive? To bring the Korban Pesach. What was the essence of bringing the Korban Pesach? A willingness to identify as Jewish. The whole notion of that in Pesach Mitzrayim, you had the blood on the doorposts so that people could see it, was a statement, I'm willing to identify myself as a Jew, not an Egyptian. Right? And even though, if you go through the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim, the Jews are pretty passive, and Hashem does everything for us, up and including Kriyas Yamsuf, right? Hashem Yilachem, Yilachem Batem Kachushun. You can be quiet, God's going to take care of you, right? But they can't go out without bringing the Korban Pesach, without identifying themselves as Jews. So the Rav, when he's going to talk about Brit Mitzrayim, he's going to talk about all the Jews who share in that identification. And that identification is not merely, you know, saying, I am Jewish, but that identification means a being part of something, caring about other Jews, helping other Jews. And this doesn't require any statement about doing mitzvah. I can be a Jew who cares about the Jewish people. I care about other Jews. I identify when they're in trouble. I care when they're. I'm happy when they're doing well. I didn't say anything at this point about being religious. Right? I'm talking about identifying with the people. And that is going to be Bris Mitzrayim. Bris Sinai, of course, what's Sinai? Sinai is Nasa Benishma, given the Aseret HaDibros. Bris Sinai is the covenant that involves keeping the Mitzvah. So you have, so what does this accomplish? And we'll go into details next week. What does this really accomplish? It says, what we have in common depends. With some Jews, what we have in common is Bris Mitzrayim. They're not observant, necessarily. They may not even be believers in God. But they share in concern about the Jewish existence. They don't deny their Jewishness, right? And they care about the fate of other Jews as well. Only those who share a religious commitment have Ristina. But by making this a two-tier thing, we now can connect to all the secular Zionists. Right? Instead of becoming communists and worrying about Russia, they became Zionists and worried about fellow Jews in Israel. They worked around in Israel. They showed all the qualities that the Rebbe is going to detail to describe that are part of Bris Mitzrayim. And this has religious significance as well. When the Rambam talks about people who lose their share to Olam Haba, so most of the things are religious, ideological, or philosophic, with exception of a Parish Minatzibur. A Parish Minatzibur means a person who doesn't identify with the Jewish people. And a person could observe all the mitzvahs and not identify the Jewish people, right? It's part of our whole construct. In fact, in the conversion process, and the Rebbe's going to talk a lot about conversion later on, maybe in a footnote, but a very, very long footnote. When the conversion process ends, it ends with the person going into the mikveh, and the Rabbanim ask them a series of questions, which of course if they have to give the right answer to finish the process, but they know what the answer is supposed to give. They're not surprise questions. So some of the questions have to do with faith. You believe in one God, you don't believe in another religion. You can't be Jewish and Christian at the same time, right? And do you believe in basic articles of faith? Reward and punishment, prophecies of the prophets, messianic era, and mitzvot. You commit yourself to observe mitzvot. Obviously the person hasn't been told everything, and no one can ever convert, because it takes forever to know everything, right? But what you've been taught, what you're not taught. And then one of the questions is, are you prepared to identify with the fate of the Jewish people? Acknowledge the fact that Jews are going to suffer from anti-Semitism. And if you're part of the Jewish people, you're going to be subject to that anti-Semitism as well. Right? So even in the formal conversion process, the identification with the people, and not only with the religious observances, is an integral part of the process. And by doing this, now the Rebbe set up two levels. So we can join in with the non-observant and the State of Israel on the level of Brit Mitzrayim, but our goal is Brit Sina, right? Not just faith, but destiny, that which we can accomplish. Elsewhere, the Rav says the same idea in a different talk, but there he talks about Bris Avos, of identification with the founders of the Jewish people, Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. He doesn't do it here. I should point out, in terms of conversion, since I mentioned it, there's a famous Rambam. There's a question, when a convert says Shmona Esrei, can they say the language that everybody else says? Elokeinu, Elokei Avoseinu, Elokei Avraham, Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei Yaakov. Right? They're our forefathers. But what if you're not a descendant of them? So the Rambam writes they can say Elokei Avraham, Elokei Yitzchak, Yaakov, because descendants of Avraham means people who absorb the values of Avraham. It doesn't meant to be taken genetically, but it's meant to be taken to value. So a convert accepts the values of Avraham. It doesn't matter who their formal ancestors really, really, really were. So this is an approach. Rav Kook, and this is not the Rav, obviously, Rav Kook justifies working with the non-religious on different grounds. And he gives more than one explanation, one that is on one hand most famous, the other hand people are uncomfortable with, is to say that they're religious and they just don't know it. Right? The very fact they're so committed to building the land, so they're reflecting religious values. They think they're secular. It's famous, it's very clever. Why is it controversial? Because telling somebody you don't know what you really are, I'm telling you who you really are. A lot of people don't take to that well. You know, that someone's going to tell me who I really am. No, I know who I really am. Now, Rav Kook gives other explanations as well. A lot of them are somewhat mystical. I'm not a big one on explaining mystical things. Besides, I'm talking about the Rav who doesn't say too many mystical things. So I'm pretty safe in not getting to it. So we're going to, next week, go into details of the two covenants, which we just started here. Right? And of course, we are going to get into this, in a certain sense, into the problem of anti-Semitism, for which many people have written books and try to explain the sources of anti-Semitism, explain them on religious terms, explain them on economic terms, play them on cultural terms, play them, in fact, these are unnatural, we don't have a land. Unfortunately, none of the explanations have successfully explained anti-Semitism. What I mean by not successfully explaining it, whereas if I can explain what caused it, then suppose I can make it disappear. They know what the problem is, right? Once they solve the problem, it'll disappear. So this, and this is not meant as a criticism of Zionism, but just as a statement of fact, apparently having our own state did not solve anti-Semitism. And early Zionism, that was one of the justifications, particularly from the secular Zionists. The religious Zionists, they need that explanation. They want to go back to our land. But for the secular Zionists, was one of the explanations was, well, why is there so much anti-Semitism? Because it's not natural. We don't have a land. We're not a normal people. People are uncomfortable with things that are not like themselves. They can't identify with. So according to that explanation, once there was the state of Israel, anti-Semitism should disappear. Unfortunately, that one didn't work. There are plenty of other good reasons for having a state, having Zionism, but that one, unfortunately, was common and it didn't accomplish its goal. I know, my time's up, somebody else.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Did people ever say to the Rav that it's problematic that Israel, Hakamat Medina, was done by Herzl and non-religious Jews, and
yeah,
all,
he talks
like,
about it. Yes.
And like the Uganda plan? Like,
he does talk about it. He says what the problems are, but he builds up this notion we share this one level of power.
So ultimately it doesn't matter. But we
no,
don't say that about...
It does matter, but we still support it. I mean, it matters in the sense we're not satisfied. We want to change it. But it doesn't matter in the sense that we don't reject the state of Israel.
Then he sees it as more of a failure of Orthodox Jews rather than...
It's probably our own failure, not being here.
Thank
you. We can do our job. He does have something.